Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barling and Barrett, a weekly look at crime and the law. My name is Simon Barrett, and joining me is veteran attorney Manny Barling. Manny, hello.
Hi, Simon. How are you this afternoon?
I'm fine, and I understand it's somewhat of a sad anniversary for you.
Well, somewhat. Today is the 43rd anniversary of my father dying of cancer. And, you know, and it's interesting because he was about my age now. And 14 years ago, I was diagnosed with malignant cancer and given 2 years to live. And I'm still alive. And I really thought about the fact that so many people in my generation have had better luck with this than my father's generation, are living so much longer. And I wanted to devote this show to all the people who are recovering or have been in some way treated for cancer in their lifetime, and today's a good day to think about everybody because, you know, we're all very fortunate, aren't we?
We are indeed. And this week we have a couple of guests joining us. My wife Jan has written many, many articles on the subject of missing and abused children, and I'm sure she'll have much to say on today's subject. Jan, glad to have you on the air again.
Thanks for having me. Hello, everyone.
And also joining us is news anchor and radio talk show host from WOW FM in Des Moines, Iowa, TJ Hart. TJ, it is great to have you on the air again.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be back with friends. I've missed you all dearly. It's great to be back.
And how's the snow situation?
Well, right now we're seeing a little bit of a warmer temperature today, and that's not always a good sign because with that we got some cloud cover coming in and 1 to 3 inches of snow after this almost melted off from a couple weeks ago.
Okay, well, enough of the depressing stuff.
There you go.
Oh, by the way, TJ, did I tell you I'm calling in from the beach in Hawaii?
I am depressed.
No, not really, but I thought it was appropriate.
I used to be out there in the Gulf of Mexico calling in on these shows for many years, and that's all changed.
Time and time again, we read news stories where some of the blame for a dreadful crime is placed firmly at the door of the, quote, system. It was the police, it was CPS or whatever the agency is called in any particular state. It was 911. It was basically everyone's fault except the person that committed the crime. And I want to ask some questions this week. Is it fair to blame the system? Are CPS, 911, etc., expected to be proactive or reactive? And where is the problem? Is it funding? Is it just purely a money and manpower issue? Or is it something else? And by way of illustration, I think what we, the panel, want to do is actually look at some actual cases. Manny, would you like us to start with the Powell family? Because I think that story has so many facets.
Absolutely. And I was looking forward to Jan's take on this because I know Jan's followed this for some period of time, and she's always my guru on all the on missing children and missing families. So, Jan, can you give us your observations? Because am I correct? You followed this from the beginning, right?
Yeah, well, whenever the mother, Susan Powell, went missing, I remember I did start it out whenever she first went missing. The case was mysterious from the very beginning, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that are in agreement with me on that. She went missing on December 7th, but the funny part was...
Well, 2009.
Yeah, that's true, but what I was going to say is that the odd part was her husband, Josh Powell, told the police that he took their two young children up. I forgot how old they were, 5 and 7 or something like, maybe younger than that. I don't remember what the age of the boys were at the time, but they said that he took these two young children out in a snowstorm, I mean freezing weather, at midnight to go camping. And when he could return the next day, his wife was gone. Well, who in the world would go out in the middle of the night, take two small children out to go camping out in open air? Well, he claims that they slept in their van. But, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me at all. And that's what kind of got my attention to the case from the beginning. I mean, that just made him look awful involved in this. It just was a sound like a phony story to me.
Well, you know, TJ, I got a quick question for you. Do men normally in your area take their wives out for camping and not come home?
No, the wife didn't go now. He said,
oh, she didn't go?
Him and the two kids. And he left.
You know,
he said that she was sick and didn't want to go.
Ah. I missed that part of it. I thought she had gone with him, not returned, and that everybody had kind of gone, you know, where could she be? But it really seems strange to me that anyone can just sort of disappear like that.
Right.
TJ, I know that you mentioned the Powell case briefly on some of your news broadcasts. I mean, didn't you find the story odd from the outset?
Yes, from the get-go. It was absolutely, it sounded very cooked up. And the police were on to it. But the thing is, without any kind of evidence linking him to her disappearance, he could only be a person of interest. They really couldn't lock him up on anything because they had a couple of elements that they needed in which to tie him to her disappearance. They didn't have it. All they had was a very kooky story that just didn't sound right. And to be quite honest with you, as a father, I would never take two small boys out into the wilderness that age. If you were doing something for scouts or something like that, it would be an appropriate age. It would have been in the early to mid-teens before you would ever do something like that with young children out in the cold to take them camping, winter camping.
Well, I agree. And what's even stranger to me about that is, well, I'm not a big camper, and I always err on the side of caution. And children are, and anyone who's, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners do have young children, children are not a picnic in those surroundings. So why anybody would rush to be out with them really astounds me. I would not rush to take my children out in that weather only because I wouldn't want to have to deal with them in that weather. And I'm sure as a father you feel somewhat the same way.
Well, certainly, but also the exposure to the elements. I mean, what do you do every day before you take your children to school in the wintertime? You bundle them up to the point where they almost can't move so they won't catch a cold. Why go out there with their tiny bodies
right
like that and expose them to something and get them prepared to or vulnerable anyway to catch a cold or maybe even pneumonia? It doesn't make sense, especially at that age. It doesn't.
Yeah, and they still to this date have not found the body, right?
Correct.
Right.
Because that's the hardest thing in criminal law is to prosecute somebody when you have no body. And we saw that with Casey Anthony, that they couldn't do anything until they finally found the body, and then it became increasingly more difficult because they could not get enough data off of the body to make a prosecution stick. And that is a major problem. Do you know for centuries you couldn't prosecute at all? And only since about 1954 have there been any grounds at all anywhere for a prosecutor to bring an action without what is called the habeas corpus, the body.
Yeah, basically the case all but went cold. You know, everyone was pointing the finger at Josh, but nothing happened in what, all of 2010?
Well, 9/11. It wasn't until recently that his father started getting a lot of notice from the police. He was allegedly videotaping or photographing young girls going to the bathroom or women going to the bathroom. Very voyeuristic. It was involving children, and there were some other things that they were investigating him on. And that's when Josh started getting spooked.
Right.
The kids started talking as
right.
well. They started remembering a little bit.
Say. The kids mm-hmm. had started talking just recently, actually more, like mommy was in the trunk of the car, mommy got lost, things like that. So, I mean, but they were supposed to be in a van, so how could mommy be in the trunk of a car is what I don't understand. So, I mean.
Well, they might have been another vehicle prior to them going camping.
True.
Or maybe trunk
that's
is just the word that they it was the only word they could define for the back of the van.
Yeah, I guess
you know,
so.
We're talking children.
Yeah, and they said that they were 2 and 4 at the time, so I couldn't
mm-hmm.
remember their ages. So that is awful young, too. But they did say that they had started talking, and, you know, to make it even more suspicious on Josh.
Right. Now, at some point, Josh lost custody of the children. I don't have the exact date, but I do know that in early December of 2011, Josh Powell renewed the custody battle for his two sons. The sons, I believe, were in the custody of their grandparents.
Chuck and Judy Cox, right.
Right. And we now move into 2012, and this is where things get very, very derailed. Wednesday, February the 1st, Josh Powell was denied custody of his two sons, and he's ordered to undergo a psychosexual evaluation and poly test. Okay, now that in itself is interesting. Why did they want to do a psychosexual evaluation on him?
Okay, wait, I'm trying to find my notes here.
I'm thinking you might have to have something to do with his father.
Well, they said that it was something to do with his computer, actually, that they had found some sort of pornography and stuff on his computer also. So that had a lot. It said that based on undisclosed materials that the Utah police discovered on his computer in 2009. So that was the reason that the judge decided that he should go through these evaluation tests first before he would give him custody of the kids.
So it took that long after finding that kind of information to finally get to that point? That is
that's
a
what
system.
We're saying, you know. Yeah. This is it's also it just didn't fall in the place the way it should have for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand the delay in all of it either.
Okay.
It's not easy to just send somebody for an evaluation. You have to have a lot of cause, and in these type cases, that kind of cause is not always easy to find because if the accused person always seems to find a way to place himself, shall we say, under a stress situation where it requires a court order. And those are not easy court orders to get.
Well, that's what happened whenever he went back to court again to try to regain custody of the kids. There was a psychologist that testified that recommended the evaluation based on the materials that they had found on his computer.
Okay, now I think February 1 is a very pivotal date, and I think it also really brings in the start of the breakdown of the system. You might disagree. You might say the system had already broken down for the Powell family. He is ordered supervised visitation rights only. Now, I am not a trained professional in the area of dealing with children and supervised visits, but I'd always been under the impression that supervised visits tended to occur in a neutral place, and there was a neutral third party present to make sure that nothing untoward went on. Does any of the panel have any comments on that?
Well, that's been my experience, and in this particular case, particularly in the Southern California area, it would be in some places involved a peace officer, and as a matter of public policy within the various offices, they would not assign a female social worker to that kind of case under those circumstances because they have fears of exactly what occurred in this case. So, yeah,
right.
That's something that, and by the way, dealing in it with the inner city problems of Los Angeles, and it was probably true in cities like New York, Simon, they're really very vigilant on these issues.
Yeah. TJ, you spent a decade in Florida, and I know that you were very involved in a number of child abuse and missing children cases. Was it your experience that supervised visitation rights were held in a neutral territory?
Many times they were, if they could. But I got to tell you, the system there, the Department of Family Services there was so underfunded and so overwhelmed and swamped. It was, they did the best they could with what they had. And not everything probably went according to plan in some cases. They did everything that they possibly could, but they were trying to do things in neutral places. But many times, or I shouldn't say many times, sometimes that just couldn't be arranged. But they had to have a supervisor and a location, and sometimes it was at the, at Powell's home, a situation like that.
It was reported, too, that this wasn't actually a supervisor that was an employee of the Department of Social and Health Services. She was a contract worker with a private agency that supervises visits for the state.
You hit it right on the head with the overwhelming number of cases, Jan, and lack of funding. Sometimes they do go out and they contract out for these people
in
that category.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, and especially in smaller jurisdictions like this one, that becomes an issue because it's hard for them to staff and it's hard for them to hire people to do some of this because the jobs are more attractive in other areas where they pay more.
Sure. That's not a high-paying job, and it's also a high-risk job.
Oh, yes. High-ulcer job, too.
But what really bothers me is this guy has been ordered to undergo a psychosexual evaluation and polygraph test, which, as you pointed out, Manny, it is not easy to push through the court system. It took time. And yet, they would still permit supervised visits inside the home, his home?
Oh, it's definitely strange. And of course, we're functioning in the dark. We don't know what was on his computer. And, I mean, it's possible it was just plain pornography, but usually what would endanger children would be something like child pornography or something that would be inconsistent with parenting. So my mind keeps going back to, okay, we'd all like to know what's on there because that has a great deal to do with the scope of protection that you provide to these children.
Well, there have been some news reports, but, do you believe them or don't you? The images involved incestuous situations.
Yeah, they said that someone said that it was they had animated incestual images on the computer. So that's kind of, I just don't understand why they would have, I don't know. To me, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, I know they're backed up and all that, but cases when they have something like this involved, you would think that they would be extra cautious over it. I don't.
Especially with a high-profile case like
that. Right, exactly. And it just.
If we can digress for a moment, animated child pornography. Where is this world going?
They said incest. I don't know if they mentioned children.
Well, that's still child pornography. Incest is child pornography. So essentially, we're now at a state where people are creating. Next thing we're going to do is here. There's 3D in pornography. I mean, this is getting ridiculous.
Oh, you're out of date, Manny. I mean, I'm sure 3D porn is readily available.
You know, and I thank God I am out of date, because I think most Americans find this so repulsive.
It really is.
Okay, so let's move on a few days. This all came down on February the 1st. On February the 5th, Josh Powell gets his supervised visitation. This social worker, who is not a state employee and certainly not a member of law enforcement, brings the two kids to Josh's house. Jen, do you want to explain what happened?
Well, according to what she said, that she pulled up in the car and the kids ran ahead of her, got out the car and ran in. And he told the kids he had a surprise for them, which would naturally excite the children and, you know, make them want to come in faster. And he got them in, shut the door, and locked it before she could even get inside the door at all. And I read where she claimed that she knocked on the door and he wouldn't let her in. But she could hear the children in there. And one, I think she said the little one was crying, and then she could smell the gas, so she went out and she called her office to try to report it. And I don't know if she called 911 at that time or when, but I don't know how long, it must have been like seconds worth. She tried to call 911. When she got on 911, they asking her all kinds of questions, and instead of just taking it as an emergency, it was like they were, I don't remember the questions they were asking her, but it was questions that was ridiculous. It just didn't make any sense, the reason she was trying to explain to him what she had, but then they couldn't get a trace on her cell phone for the where she was at. She had to get the address of where she was, and it was a big confusion there too, but not that I don't think it would have really saved their lives, so if they would have sent them the second she called anyway. I don't believe there was enough time. Josh knew what he was doing. He had that all planned out, and he was going to kill those kids, and then he's going to kill, you know, make sure he's kill himself at the same time. So
okay, it's fair to say that even if the system had worked just the way that it's supposed to work, that the kids would not be alive today. However, we don't know that for certain. As the timeline that I'm looking at, and says that it took 7 minutes of questions.
Right.
Before the 911 operator actually agreed to dispatch someone. Now,
that's outrageous. I used to work in the 911 bubble a long time ago, and there are questions that you must ask, and it's all to, you know, protect everybody and make sure that there's adequate instruction, direction, and everybody's covered, you know, legally and what have you. But 7 minutes, that's outrageous. It shouldn't take you much more than 90 seconds.
Okay, now
Simon, in terms of 911, 7 minutes is about the equivalent of a century.
Yes,
right.
It is. You need 90 seconds. That's all you need to get a car out there.
Okay, now it gets worse, though. All right, it took 3 minutes for the 911 operator to figure out that this wasn't some, you know, Joe Knucklehead calling, but a social worker who was smelling gas, had just been locked out of a supervised visitation. So what does the dispatcher do? Dispatches the police, but with a non-priority code.
Actually, in a situation like that, that would have been right underneath what they call a 1032. That would have been probably right up there with that. 1032 is a subject with a gun. This probably should have been prioritized maybe a notch or two below that, and it should have been a very high priority call.
Right. It was dispatched with normal priority.
Well, in our state, when you deal with children, they are, along with gunshots fired, the highest priority.
Correct.
It deems the safety of children as paramount, and I just find this so difficult. It just is very difficult for me to accept. You know, I blame this on instructions to the operator in part, not just that basically they're trying to curb the use of 911, that they've had the problems where they've had too many weird calls, people going, save my cat, you know, the litany.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah. But what happens is there's pressure now in the operators not to, to send things out too quickly. So now they start erring on the side of economic caution instead of addressing the real issue, which is the health and safety of the caller.
It's all about public safety. Right.
Yep. You agree there, TJ?
I do. It's all about public safety. But I will tell you that there are people who abuse the 911. It's not an everyday occurrence, but it does happen. It's more of an annoyance than anything else. And, you have to do what's right. You can't always do what's comfortable.
I thought it was actually an offense to abuse the 911 system.
It is. I had to sit in court a couple of times because there were people who were charged with abusing 911. I happened to be the guy holding the phone, answering it. And what have you, and they've done a little bit of time and paid a pretty substantial fine for it, too, as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
As they should.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the way to solve it is with fines and follow-up. But I think in some of the smaller jurisdictions, especially, I mean, this is probably the most heinous crime in that city in the last 50 years. So
maybe 100, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, as I pointed out, I live in a jurisdiction where we have events in Southern California that make people react a lot quicker, but in some of these smaller jurisdictions, you can't get them to take it seriously. Oh, that only happens in L.A. You know, it doesn't happen here, but it happens everywhere.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just peeking into the chats that are coming in about this program, our program, and someone makes the comment that one of the 911 operators who took a call from a social worker outside Josh Powell's house said in an interview with NBC's Dateline he had no idea of the severity of the situation.
I bet he didn't.
But TJ, you said that you spent some time in the 911 bubble. I mean, surely that's like 911, 101. You know.
Well, the thing is that the person who answers the call is a high turnover rate of those because a lot of times you have suicides. And I'll tell you that the brief time I was there, I was 20 for 21 and getting them to not do it. And that one. Did it for me. And there's a high turnover rate there, so you have to keep training and retraining. You get fresh people in there all the time, and sometimes they don't know because they don't have that experience. They don't have that institutional knowledge. And the first person who picks up that call is not necessarily the most qualified. It's the dispatcher who gets it after that call has been shipped to the proper jurisdiction, whether it's a police, fire, or a state police in many cases, where you have a unified 911 system.
All right, well, I'm going to ask Jan this question. Jan, did the system break down, in your opinion?
Yes, but in my opinion, though, it happens all too often. and I know I hear the excuses that their budget's too low, or they don't have enough people at work, or there's always an excuse. And this is a system that our government is supposed to be to protect people. I mean, it's there. That's for that reason. They need to put more people. If their budget's too low, the government needs to raise it. If nothing else, I've said this before, there's thousands of people in this country that volunteer work. Put them in the offices, let them behind the desk, put the people that's trained out for things like this. Then they would have more help, if nothing else. I mean, there's got to be an answer to this somewhere, because these people, I mean, there's too many cases. I have worked just the last 3 years. I don't know how many cases I have worked on that I've seen that it's because they didn't have enough budget. The budget was too low to send the people. And they put kids back into custody with parents that wind up getting killed because of this. And it's really, it's not just one or two occasions. I mean, it's getting more and more and more that you see every day. And every time you see it, it's never their fault. It's always because the budget. That's what they want to holler, the budget. And it's
well, let me offer you a different thought on this, Jan. I don't blame this on a budget, because I don't care what your budget is. This person took a phone call, and out of that phone call was given a distress situation. And I don't care what they're paid. I don't care if it's a person off the street, for that matter. They should understand what they're dealing with and the severity of a call. If someone calls you and they say, I'm dealing with a lockout situation with someone who's in danger and happens to be a child, I don't think that's rocket science. I think if you put a 17-year-old high school senior or 18-year-old high school senior on that call, they would have made a better decision than the one made by this individual.
I agree. It's the training and the follow-through that
was
the problem
here. But then they're saying that the budget doesn't allow for that.
Not the point. The point is somebody took the phone call. And whoever took that phone call, I don't feel has a right to use the budget as an excuse, because they got the phone call. If the phone call wasn't made because they couldn't afford a better phone system or something like that, that's fine. But that phone call went through, as it should, and once it was received, now we're no longer dealing with that issue. We're dealing with the competency of the person who answered the phone.
Right. The 911 operator. Yeah.
Yeah.
In that case, I know what you're talking about, Jan, with the department. Yeah, they do have a problem with the budget, but we're going here with this, with the telephone call. That operator should have had the proper training.
Yep, you're right.
It should have
had
the proper certification to deal with that appropriately, and I don't think that person probably did.
Well, apparently it wasn't a rookie operator. But you know,
and that's
here's
really
the thing.
Sad,
even,
because
even
that's a lazy
with
operator.
Zero training, if you stick me at the end of a phone and someone says, I'm a social worker, I've just been locked out of a supervised visitation, and I smell gas coming from the house.
That should have put an alarm right
there. I mean, I'd be hitting every red button.
ASAP. Yeah.
You know, I'd be hitting every red button within my reach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my point, is that it doesn't take rocket science to identify this problem. And it's not the kind of problem that is difficult for anyone beyond a certain age to understand. So I don't care how long that person was on the job. I think this is a relatively rudimentary decision to make. It's so classical that it's almost astounding to me. So to me,
it's inexcusable is what it is.
Yeah.
Right.
It is.
But you know, you're cutting to the chase. I'm going to why it's inexcusable, and that is because any person in the world exhibiting any common sense would see the danger to this.
Correct.
There's a couple of other cases I want to get to, but, you know, before we move on, Manny, how do you fancy fielding a call?
How do I sense a bad feeling at Cole? Well, I won't make the All-Star team, but I'll take a shot at it.
Okay. We've had a caller on hold for almost 10 minutes.
Wow, that's patience. My compliments.
Patience is a virtue. Caller from the 208 area code, what's your name and what's your question for us?
Hi, all. It's great to talk to you. It's Peggy from Idaho. And, man, the passion is high here. I am born and raised in Utah and moved to Idaho. But I think the system failed in every respect, starting from when their mother went missing in Utah. Here you have a father that takes his kids out camping. Okay, bad move in a blizzard, and I think it was 12 degrees or something outside, is gone all night, says that he couldn't remember that he needed to be to work on Monday. He left on a Sunday and blew off work, tells the cops that, oh, God, I forgot. I thought it was still Sunday. So, I mean, you, right from the very beginning, he's not a father that should be in care of children, just starting there. So I'm really not sure why he ended up with supervised visits in the first place. There were so many flags going off from so many different places. His story didn't make sense. Then he moved the children to Washington in with his father that has, you know, child porn on his computer, and he has cartoon porn on his computer. I mean, there's just flags all over the place, and why they were even in a situation that they were in supervised visits in any other place other than child welfare offices or something like that is just beyond me. I'm just tired of us making excuses for all these people that fail these kids. I'm tired of it. And how many kids have to die before people start screaming about this? I mean, we've lost child after child because our system's failing them. And I think we as parents need to start standing up and saying, you know, we're not taking excuses anymore. You see a father in a position like this, he doesn't deserve supervised visits. He's made bad choices all the way down the line. And now I'll step off my soapbox.
Well, that's fine.
I'm just so tired of losing kids.
It was very true. It was very passionate, and it was very true. And you're echoing the sentiments of probably 99% of the people in the United States of America right now.
Yeah. How's my favorite caller from Idaho doing?
Thank you very much. I love your program, and I was so happy to hear you back on the program, and so glad to hear Jan back on. I share her passion about our children, and you know, I've got 14 grandkids that I'm helping to raise, and I'm just tired of losing. We just keep having children disappear and die because we're not paying attention to who's caring for him, and I mean the it's so disturbing. And
okay.
They can come up with a billion excuses.
You have 14 grandchildren. Congratulations. Let me ask you a question. It's actually a very serious question. How would you feel if you went to visit one of your one or two or more of your grandchildren, and you got out of the house, got out of the car, walked to the house, smelt gas, and panicked, called 911, and they give you the runaround?
I would have beat the damn door. I would have kicked it in at that point. I mean, I get it that she was. I mean, I don't know how they got into the house before she did. I guess lucky for
her,
because I think he would have killed her. Yeah. But, I mean, just bad mistakes all the way down the line. I can't even figure out why they allowed him to have it in his house anyway. That just seems, it's like Manny said, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. I mean, there were flags from day one when their mother went missing, and
right.
You continue to allow that. I just, you know, I'm just wondering about the authorities that have control over telling us how we should, you know, settle these issues. And I just think there were so many things that they could have used, saying you don't get to have that. You know, it's like.
Let me offer you a thought. Simon and I had a conversation about this before the show, and we've discussed this off and on. Simon spent some time working, structuring, helping people in a homeless shelter, and he can explain that himself. And as he pointed out early on, everything seemed so horrible to him. But after a while, you sort of get used to it, and sometimes people get hardened to it. And that's true also the 911 call, sadly, is that people then all of a sudden don't look at things the same way, or they hear it's the same thing over and over, and there's a numbing part of it, which of course bothers me. I don't know how anyone can be numb to the plight of others, but that's something that happens to these people, as it does to policemen, right?
Yeah,
right.
I will tell my story. So the first year that I worked out of this homeless shelter, I was in shock and horror. I looked at what other staff members were doing, and it was so callous, it was so uncaring. But I'll tell you what, 3 years later, I've never been callous, but it was so much harder to treat everyone with that same high level of care and respect, because you saw the same story day in, day out, and it hardens you.
Well, harden isn't the right word, Simon. Let's be fair. It numbs people.
Right.
It's a numbing effect more than it is a hardening, because as you point out, you've never stopped feeling for them. You just sort of get hardened to the same story and the repetition.
But don't you think in this case, Simon, I mean, they have a man in court that they're taking away his parental, taking away the children out of the home until he completes these evaluations. Shouldn't that have told someone, hey, don't take him to the house where he's, and supposedly he had just set up that house to look like it was a nice living home. He wasn't even living there, from what I've heard and understand, just from in fact, she went missing very close to where I used to live in Utah. So I sort of know what's happening in that neighborhood still, as my ex-husband and his family still lives there. But, you know, let's quit making, if you're protecting the children, protect them. Quit making dumb mistakes, you know, that the children end up dying over. And if you're not, then just say you're not. I mean, let's find a better system. But to pretend like you're protecting the children with all the information that they had and say that they were doing it in the best interest of the children, those children's best interests were never taken into account.
Well,
never.
Let me get a little controversial on you. I grew up in a neighborhood that had a fair amount of Mormons. I've grown up among them. And in Utah, as we all know, particularly in the southern part of Utah, there are issues with children and families and, you know, multiple wives and all the rest of that. And sometimes I have felt that in Utah there's a different standard in an application for how children and some of the other issues are dealt with. And I wonder if you have any feelings whether any of those issues that people kick around, and I'm not talking about people who criticize Mormons, but that I listen to within my Mormon friends who at times are appalled at what goes on in southern Utah, whether any of that has any effect on that particular area where you grew up and she was actually missing. Do you feel any of that?
Oh, I absolutely do, and it's why I'm living in Idaho and not Utah. I was raised in that system, and that's a whole other topic I'd like to talk to you about. They have some really strange laws in Utah, and It is absolutely why I moved. I mean, in Utah, you have, well, that's completely off topic, but yeah, there are absolute, they favor keeping the families together, but this happened in Washington. I mean,
well, no, but the original law started there, and one of the reasons that I say that is it sort of loses its flavor when it goes to another state, and if the state where the events occurred isn't vigilant, the next state doesn't pick up the importance of it. So normally, this case would have been transferred into the state of Washington, there would have been a much more alarm. I've also spent a lot of time in Washington, and I think Washington has a wonderful record on many of these issues. The state in general is an extraordinarily kind, thoughtful place, and noted for into that. And so I wonder whether they were somewhat caught short because they didn't get much from the other jurisdictions.
I think that's absolutely the truth. I think West Valley City did drop the ball in not, you know, escalating some of the things that they were holding close to their vest. You know, they should have turned many things over, not to the public, but to the people that were investigating and trying to keep those children safe, and I don't think that they did that. But I think that that jurisdiction had some issues anyway. I mean, they needed more help. They they aren't very good at doing those kinds of things. So, yeah, that issue started way back then. And Washington has said we weren't made aware of these things until this happened. So, some of it, you know, they should have turned over to Washington, and maybe that all could have been prevented. But just so many things happened in that case, and it's just so sad that we've lost another two children, you know. And look how many we lost.
Yeah, I'll voice this thought for you. I've had a number of times when I found the state of Utah very uncooperative in providing information involving issues with children and families that ended up in the Los Angeles courts. It's almost like they're afraid that if they say something, their dirty linen is spread elsewhere, and they just don't want anyone to see or hear some of this. And I find that
there's a lot. Yeah, there's
a lot of that goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. And it absolutely is the reason why I chose to move out of state, because there are a lot of things that go on in that state that they try to cover for their own, and it's sad. It's all very sad because, like I said, we're you know, trying to learn another lesson from losing another two children, and that's distressing to me. I mean, we've just lost a lot this year, and they're beautiful children that could have grown up and lived such wonderful lives. And so that's my input. But I'm so glad you guys are back on the air. Thank you so much. I enjoy your programs.
And thanks for calling in again. You know, I'll recognize your voice forever. You're never going to escape us.
Thank you,
well,
baby.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Have a great day.
And you. And TJ, I want to flip the coin entirely. You and I talked earlier today, and
yes.
There are cases like the Powells where the system has obviously just fallen apart. We can sit back and play armchair quarterback and, you know, explain that, you know, it shouldn't have taken the 911 operator 8 minutes and to do this and et cetera, et cetera. But the other side of the coin is that there are many cases where CPS get themselves involved in situations where they shouldn't.
And they sometimes get a little overzealous trying to do the right thing. And it gets to the point where it's just absolutely obnoxious, and you find parents who've done absolutely nothing finding themselves with their children ripped away from them based on a neighbor who may have had a complaint against these people for something completely different. And they figured that'll just, you know, fix their little red wagon, I'll get their kids taken away from them. And it's very juvenile, but it happens. And, of course, most people who are involved with children in these agencies want to protect children. That's all they really want to do. And God bless them. They got the heart, they got the spine, they got the stamina to do that. But sometimes it gets a little bit misguided, and sometimes that happens on that end where it gets a little totalitarian, and it gets just, you know, right off the rails. Otherwise, you've got the situation with the Powell incident here where not enough attention was paid to it. And trying to find a happy medium, I guess, is really what needs to be done. And also, I think it all gets back to training. I think it has to be done not only at the agency level there, but also at the 911 level as well. All people who are involved in public safety, and especially when it involves children, I think the training has to be up to date. I don't care what the finances are. The training must be there. So people are sharp, people are aware, and people aren't making bad decisions in haste.
Well, I think some of it, too, TJ, has to do with the mission statement. And when that mission statement is altered because you're trying to save money, then the mission statement becomes diluted. And that's what I see here, is that there's a dilution in the message, and there should never be a dilution in the message, and it's just not acceptable. And that's what bothers me most, is I just have the feeling here that, you know, either discipline or prior problems with other people, whatever the excuse is, became a reason for people not doing things, and that's never an acceptable reason.
Okay, I know that we could talk for hours and hours and hours on the Powell case, but
sure.
There's a couple of other cases that I really do want to look at, not in great detail, but again from the perspective of, you know, has the system fallen down? That there was a really sad story that Jen put together earlier this week concerning a 7-year-old who effectively killed his 2-year-old sister. Jen, would you like to explain it?
Well, I'll try. It was a 7-year-old that he ended up setting his house on fire, and the 2-year-old girl was caught in the house and she couldn't get out, and she died in the fire. But the sad part was that his mother had said that he had a history of this kind of things, that he had also set another house on fire. And she was trying, she said, I'll quote her, as she said, "We've tried to get our son help." And she said, "He set fire to our neighbor's trailer a few months ago on Christmas night. He left in the middle of the night and rode his bike up 460 for 4 miles. The little boy was clear signs that he needed help. And it's really sad because apparently she couldn't get him the help that he was needing. Then she said he's also been cruel to animals by killing them. But now they say that he's getting help from Tucker's Mental Institution. But it's still, where was the help before his little sister died? If they don't do something with this little boy, there's going to be more people killed in his path if something doesn't, take over, if the system comes up with, well, we're too low budget to help,
Manny, in some ways this is an opposite situation from the Powells. Here, we apparently, and I do use the word apparently, have a situation where a family recognizes that, they have a problem child, and they have reached out, and nothing has happened. What's the answer to that one?
Well, strangely, in my parents' generation, these children were referred to as bad seeds. And you might
Yeah,
that's an old expression,
right? Yeah, I remember
right
that, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's really what we have here. I've done a lot of reading in this area throughout my career, and sadly, he exhibits all of the tendencies of a future serial killer. And
exactly.
This is usually where you see it too, right, TJ? And this is usually where it starts, and this is what bothers me most. Historically, we've allowed this to slip under the cracks, and we have not done a good job in our society of identifying children who could be dangerous to society as a whole. You know, and it's funny, I'm sure everybody can tell this story. You pick up the paper one day and you see some kid arrested for some heinous crime, and you say to yourself, you know, I went to school with that kid, and I always knew he was going to turn out bad, right?
Right.
You know? But the fact is, everybody's correct when they say that, because children and people identify. And I think that most men would tell you, Jan, they can look around and they can tell men that they know are going to be dangerous in society when they get older. So we, you know, but nothing gets done about it. In the same way, I'm sure that as a woman, you could look around your classes and tell which women were going to be sociopathic. I mean, they just sort
right.
of see that in your class, right? So here we have a country that the average citizen can identify problem children, but our particular form of government allows such a level of freedom that we haven't really found a way to really control this problem in our country. So as I point out at different times, and you probably never heard me say this, TJ, but when your population goes up, so do your problems like this. You know, and I always point out, you look at China. China's got, what, 300 billion people, or 3 billion people? So their number of potential psychopaths goes up exponentially with the amount of their population. So if they got a population of 3 billion, they have that many more psychopaths, serial killers, child abusers, and the numbers just go up. So as our country has gotten larger and larger, the number of these problems have increased more and more. So that, to me, is a problem we're experiencing. And we as a nation must sit down and start identifying these people and protect ourselves from these people.
One thing that comes to mind is that, you know, do you set up a division of pre-crime, though? And that's another thing that you'll have people who are of the libertarian bent come at you and say, well, just because they're exhibiting signs doesn't mean that this person is automatically guilty of anything other than what he's already done, which is kill animals or set a house on fire. I'm purely being argumentative here just for the sake of the argument, because I do believe that we do have to be watchful of these signs, and we do have to monitor because there are lives at stake here, potential lives at stake. This kid exhibited the classic example, as you said, of a mass murderer. And the first name that came to mind was Jeffrey Dahmer when you told me when we heard of the torture of the small animals. That's the first name that came to my mind, that monster.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you do want to prevent that, but coming at it also from the total libertarian bent, do you want to have a department of pre-crimes?
Mm-hmm. Well, you can adopt my policy. I try not to listen to Ron Paul any more than I have to.
I try not to either. It makes my teeth hurt.
You know, and you know, I can make a joke out, but the fact is that's also one of the problems that my complaints with the Tea Party, while I agree with everything they say and I support it all, when they offer solutions, those solutions don't work because they basically want to reduce the size of our government. And under their thoughts, we would actually have had more problems with the 9/11 cases that we just discussed a little bit earlier. And so what do? I have an understaffed department as it is, so what do you do next? You know, you create a department? Are we at the time of Philip K. Dick's Adjustment Bureau, where we have people who do nothing but go around and change the direction our society is going because of potential crimes? It is a difficult decision for us to make. But this is not a case, to me, of guessing. This is a case where he is exhibited the kind of tendencies where he should be compelled in some form of therapy, period.
Oh, indeed, because he did exhibit the classic signs. I mean, those are the classic signs.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So if the parents did, in fact, reach out, and I have to admit that all I'm going on is
you know, news reports. I haven't seen any factual evidence. But if the parents did reach out and say, hey, you know, we've got a little monster on our hands, why couldn't social services, CPS, whatever, you know, carve some time out to take a look at this kid?
Well, again, you're back to this argument, Simon, that these people are so overburdened. The minute you raise the specter of that, their eyes start rolling and they start going, oh, God, you know, we can't even keep up with what we're doing. And there is some truth to that, by the way, that they are having trouble.
There is.
But, you know, it's kind of like that old adage, you pay now, you pay later. And if we don't do some level of preventative law, and I might throw in preventative medicine also, then we're going to reap the results of that, and the results of that are increased crime, more costs. The same way Ronald Reagan allowed all the mental ill to be released from mental institutions under the guise that families would take care of them, and in fact they didn't. And we have a situation now where the cost of mental health in our country is at its highest level. So, you know, if we don't prevent some of these things, they're just going to happen over and over again.
All right. I'll bite. How do we prevent it? I mean, everyone is shouting from the rafters that we've got no budget, we got no money, we can't do this, we can't hire people. So, you know, how do we fix it?
Well, first of all, Simon, one of the problems in this country to me is we test for the wrong things. So here we have a situation where there's all this school testing for one purpose or another to determine funding. You know all the reasons. Well, I think that money would be far better spent if we took an effort and started testing children psychologically. And I'm sure their parents go, I don't want anybody testing my child psychologically. Well, maybe when we see their child, we probably should, you know?
But, well, maybe they're afraid of the reflection it might have on them. I think that's where
absolutely.
That all goes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, who want, you know, there's a certain amount of embarrassment in families if a child is considered to have a mental health problem. That's been a problem in our society that's required a great deal of counseling and things that change people's attitude and children's attitudes about mental health, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So I think that, you know, psychological testing is a great idea, but you try and get that past the powers that be. I mean, no one's going to go for that because immediately we're into the, you know, pre-crime idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we certainly are. And guess what? I had a few members of my class when I was growing up. I wish we were in the pre-crime era, you know. And I think everybody, every listener has had the same response I'm saying. Somewhere along the line, they went to school with someone where they just felt someone had to do something about that child because they were going to grow up to be difficult. And my classic one is I went to grammar school with Jim Morrison of the Doors. And I always remember...
answers so many of my questions.
Well, he didn't last long because... And you know why I remember him so well? Some kid tried to take a Tory. Remember those little wooden mallets where you pound the pegs through the holes?
Yeah.
Well, Morrison did not care for that, so he whacked the kid over the head with the mallet. And that should have been the first warning of what was to come for everybody. So... And I don't want to...
Well, he provided some great music along with checking himself out a little early in the club, in the 27 club, but I mean...
Yeah, but he was, you know, he was really dangerous to himself, and he was basically a pretty good human being. I didn't... We went to different schools after that. I saw him occasionally because in those days the San Fernando Valley portion of Los Angeles wasn't that large. We were never friends, but he seemed after that to really only be a danger to himself. But, my God, you know, I mean, that wasn't a real insight. So as his fame grew and his insanity and craziness grew, I would say to myself, yep, that's the Jimmy Morrison I remember. But
whacking kids different. On the head with a Fisher-Price mallet, wow.
Yeah, yeah, it was, and you're right, it was the old Fisher-Prices. And But anyway, make a long story short, that's the way most of us feel about somebody we went to school with. And I'm sure you have your list, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I've got three or four of them. They're all doing fine in the Indiana State Penitentiary.
Yep.
So.
And, you know, and I bet you said...
They're
yep,
great
but,
guys, just superbly misunderstood.
Yeah, right. I've known a few of those misunderstood ones myself. But anyway, but that's the point to all of this, is that, yes, society has warning signs from day one, and yes, I've known some that have, some people that have really, you know, changed their life in such a dramatic way, I couldn't be happy with them, but it was really born out of fire. They had to have some horrible event in their life cause them to reassess their life and where they were going. And,
mm-hmm.
and so I think there's plenty of that, and I'm sure even if you talk to Morrison's parents at the time, or really just about anybody about their child, they will say, no, not my child. No,
oh,
no,
no, never is.
No, not my kid. Nothing wrong with him.
Oh, okay, so I'm looking at the clock here. This is a great discussion, and I want to throw more fuel on the fire with a third case that was reported this week.
Okay.
Missouri mother slashes her own daughter's throat. Jan, would you like to give us the story?
The baby. It was a baby, 9-month-old baby that she had. And the woman had problems, clearly mental problems. She reportedly had went to her pastor or a pastor of the First Baptist Church in Camdenton, Missouri. And she told him, take my baby, take my baby. She hollered it out to him. And he said that she more or less tossed her baby into his arms and said that, tie me down. And then she said, possession, possession, like she was possessed with something or another. And he said that later she stopped talking, she got out a piece of paper and wrote on the paper, do not let me harm the baby. And what the pastor did, he sat there and he prayed with her. And then she tried to grab the baby to leave. She was going to run out of the church. And the church people called 911, and I guess I'm not sure exactly what events happened, whatever, but eventually the Missouri Children's Division took the baby from the mother. But then they turned around and gave her back to her for unknown reasons. I mean, I don't know the circumstances. I couldn't find out what the circumstances were, but they gave the baby back to her. And this was, I think, in September, October. And then last 1 or 2 weeks ago, I think it was 2 weeks ago, the woman's adult son called the police and said that his mother and his little sister were gone, and he didn't know where they were. So the deputies come out to look for her, and they found her in the woods on the ground holding the baby. And they thought at first that the baby was dead. But the baby looked up and held its head up, and they seen that she was still alive, so one of the deputies grabbed her and wrapped her up and brought her to the ambulance from the brand. They said at this time, I couldn't find out if the baby's still alive or not, but at that time they said she was alive, but she was in critical condition. But the mother had slashed her throat, and I believe she slashed her own, or she cut herself too, but... I mean,
no,
this woman was out, you know, screaming for help, and they turned around and just gave her the baby back afterwards, and that baby would have never had this happen to her if they would have just kept the baby and done something with her instead. But now they've got her in jail for first-degree assault and armed criminal action held on a $200,000 bond. I mean, that's not helping this baby right now, you know. I mean, this baby's one that's suffering with a cut throat.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So here we go again. You know, has the system fallen down? Is it broken? I mean, I don't think that, you know, in any case that we've discussed today shows that more than this one.
Well, there are two things at play here because, and maybe I'm stretching a little bit, but there is a case that's now in Detroit where a confession to a Baptist minister may be admissible in court. And I don't know how this plays in with this case, but it could play into others. Many times when you have that conversation with your pastor or your priest or your rabbi or your imam or your mullah, that is supposed to be sacred and confidential. But evidently the people at this church saw that this was a big enough affair that they called the police. Now, the problem might not be with the church in this case, and it probably isn't. But whatever agency returned that child back to mom, knowing the facts of the matter, and I don't know how much they knew from the church aspect at the time that they handed the baby back over, but something was missed. Something was missed big time.
Right. But, even if it is on legal technicalities, I mean, that just...
No, a lot of this, Dan, is a problem in smaller jurisdictions. Using our caller from Idaho's description, because it applies to other jurisdictions, you know, they don't want to usurp the family, they err on the side of the children staying with the family. It depends on the interests of the state, and not every state has the same view. But as I point out, here in California, these are treated like the most serious kinds of matters. And in all of these cases, that child would have been removed from the home for purposes of safety. And yet I see these smaller jurisdictions not taking as strong and as hard a view as we do here.
Hmm.
And that's what bothers me is, and again, because we have a larger population, have a larger window into these things, because, again, the numbers of your population increases the numbers of the events of everything that we're talking about.
Oh,
so,
sure. It's a multiplier effect.
Yeah, sure. And so as a result, experience has taught us a lot more than some of these various states seem to accept is going on. And I think sometimes they're just horribly naive.
Here's the thing, though. I mean, why is there this huge disparity between states? If we make the basic assumption that we know right from wrong, everyone should be on the same page.
Well, Simon, has it ever occurred to you, using a political analogy, there are blue states and red states on issues like child care, as well as there are blue states and red states on everything from contraception to abortion care. So those same divisions really sort of carry through in a variety of different issues. And a lot of these are not surprisingly similar in those states. And I'm not putting a value that it's good, bad, or otherwise. Some of this goes to the philosophy of people in those states about how children are removed from families and when. And we're advancing viewpoints right now that may not be popular in some areas.
Well, Missouri, if you go by red state, blue state, it'd be a purple state because there's a great mix of ideologies in that state as I cover politics. And it depends on what part of that state that took place and the ideology of those who are running that segment of the agency at that time. So,
yeah, I agree, and it is a very, very real issue. And your state is one of the better educated, more erudite states in the United States, and yet its views on many of these issues are substantially different than other states. So,
okay. Iowa is pretty much a no nonsense state. You don't have to show them anything; they're just very no nonsense, and it doesn't matter if they're red or blue. The whole mindset of Iowa is, all right.
Okay.
Forget,
forget politics.
Right.
Forget politics. I mean, you know, you
talking about ideology.
You, I don't care if you're a Marxist. I'd have more fun if he was. Here's a situation where a child is in a grave medical condition inflicted by a mother, and the state, wherever it might be, you know, had full knowledge of the background. How did they let this happen?
Incompetence. I mean, it goes down to right now, you know, are these people fully trained in order to carry out their jobs? And it seems that the theme of incompetence from the 911 operator with the Powell case, the people who made the decision to return the baby to a mother who thought she was possessed, incompetence, making bad decisions.
I agree. In fact, I think many of us would argue that it, incompetence is a raging problem throughout our country.
I thought it was a college course these days.
There's a lot of that going around.
Yeah.
Well, I know that, I don't know for sure if it's just because I have been working with these cases just these past 3 years, but it sure seems to me like more and more of this is going on. I mean, every time I turn around, my emails is just flooded with notices about different cases similar to this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad because it's going on. It just keeps going. And it's not stopping. It's not getting any better. It's getting worse.
Well, herein lies the big question. Is it actually getting worse? Or is it that through news media like the internet, more and more cases are getting reported? I don't know the answer to that.
I would almost imagine that because people are finding out these things because of the immediacy of information, that thank God some of this is being exposed and to a higher degree and to a higher level, and perhaps more can be done about it. I want to believe that, there once upon a time there was a good old day, but I tell you what, I think sometimes back in the good old day, a lot of people just kept their mouths shut and looked the other way. So I think it might be the information coming to light in this new era.
Well, yeah, and let's talk about control of the media. Right now, the Internet is the new version of the Gutenberg press in the sense that it's allowed the world to communicate without the structure of governments, which the Arab Spring is proving as much as anything we've seen in a long time. And so there's literally an ability in this world to publish information, books and other things, as it turned out several hundred years ago with the Gutenberg press, that could not be stopped by governments, or the worst enemy of all, apathy. Because right now, networks pick and choose what they show and what they fill in with that hour. Then they have the issue of, they got to be careful what they say because so many of their sponsors are drug companies and they don't want to offend them. So then there's always a list of people that and things they can't do, which has just gotten worse and worse. So you get away.
I think it's a little oversimplified, but you're right. There are some people that they have to kneel to, and I'll tell you that it's very blatant in the cable industry, both right and left, and in the middle. I mean,
yeah.
It all depends on who's footing the bill. I mean,
and by the way,
TV owns MSNBC, and look where that's coming from. And then you got Fox owned on the other end by Rupert Murdoch, and look where that's coming from. I mean, we're talking extremes on both sides.
And you're talking about NBC being controlled by Disney, or excuse me, ABC, ESPN, and the whole group of them. Yeah.
ABC is controlled by Disney.
Yeah. And by the way, I can give you the longer version. The show just isn't long enough for the longer version. And,
sure.
And that is essentially one of the problems we're facing. The good part of it is we're on the air right now. We're raising a large audience who's very interested in this subject, who care a great deal, that are ignored by the mainstream media because the mainstream media don't see these as holding attention more than the classic 3 days, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly. It's a typical 72-hour news cycle.
right. And by the way, news is something. Both my wife and I vote for Emmys and are involved in the industry. And actually, when this is over, I'm going to a birthday party for the former head of Fox News. So I listen to these, and I'm going to get an evening full of reporters complaining to me about what goes on inside of the various studios and the limitations placed on them. And not long ago, I listened to George Clooney joke about someone was asking about what he was doing in Darfur, and he said, well, I'm basically running all of the shows my father would come home and claim that they wouldn't allow him to run on the networks.
And that's right. Clooney's father was a big-time broadcaster out of Cincinnati and then to the networks. You're right.
Yeah, well, actually, Nick did the nightly news here in L.A. for years. He was also an old friend. And, in fact, my friend's birthday I'm going to is hired and fired him in L.A. So we have a it's one of those where I'll have a kind of a funny relationship. But, yeah, and so what's amount to is this has expanded the world in a very positive way, but it also has a certain amount of negative side effects that we're dealing with and discussing here today, is picking and choosing stories. People worried about what they do in life because they may show up on the evening news, which is a concern for businesses like, will I be picked up? It isn't so much will I be in the evening news. It's like, will I show up in some cable show? And I've heard people say that to me.
It's a genuine concern.
Yeah. So, somewhere there's somebody going, oh, God, they got us on cable today. But
you
really,
60 Minutes showed up for your door. That was a good day to quit.
it really is.
Am I hearing the pair of you say that essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, news is dead on mainstream media?
No.
Pretty much.
No, it isn't. Wait a minute, TJ. Let me just offer you a thought. Mainstream media does well with minorities and people who live below the poverty line because they can't afford some of these very expensive cable, packages. So basically, if you look at the news and the commercials on the news, they're really designed for people who below a certain income level who can't afford that particular lifestyle, and that is extraordinarily sad. Because in many respects, that group needs the benefits of cable more than any single group in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And do you disagree with that at all, TJ?
Well, a little bit, because what happens is that it's there. I don't know how widely consumed it is, because when I watch those the CBS Evening News, and I watch maybe perhaps ABC, I see Centrum Silver, I see Cialis, I see those commercials on there. They don't have anything to do with a person's race or income level. It has something to do with their age.
I don't agree. If you look at the breakdown from the drug companies' money is selling greater to minorities and people of lesser income because, among other things, they're on federal programs that are paying for it. And the incidence of poor health is much higher and impoverished people because they can't afford to eat the foods and use the treatments that are available to the wealthy. And that's an argument involving food, which Simon will tell you I'm an absolute expert. I've written 4 books on this topic. Mm-hmm. And that is a problem, is that people cannot get the quality of food and medicine, and the ads that are run on the TV are run primarily for the people who shop within the products available in that market.
Are you talking about the local aspect, the direction of the ad, or are you talking about the national aspect?
Well, I'm talking about the national ads that run on standard, free TV, over the airwaves. Is that those commercials are geared to a marketplace that shop much differently than the so-called upper class or wealthy or whatever you want to call them this week. The advantaged in our country. Okay.
I'm going to stop the pair of you bickering.
Are we bickering?
We're not bickering. We're just having a discussion.
I didn't know you were here, Simon. Are you here too? Do you know who this guy is, TJ? I don't know who he is anymore. Who is this guy?
I'm going to set up a separate program and just let you two go at it.
He always makes these promises, doesn't he?
Don't tease me.
But I'm looking at the clock, and there's
just one more story that I want to bring up. It has nothing at all, well, nothing directly to do with abused or missing children, but it does concern an old favorite of this program, Leonard Perdella.
Oh, boy.
Yes. Yeah, you remember him, TJ?
I used to get a few phone calls in the middle of the evening, yes.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I've had a few.
There, didn't he?
I've had a few close encounters with him as well.
He's always treated me well, I'll tell you that. He's always been a gentleman, and our discussions have always been above board. But
and here's the
tell
latest.
Him to get that in the middle of the evening.
Right. Here's the latest deal, and Manny, this comes from your neck of the woods. I picked it up on from the L.A. Times. That there is a serial killer on death row. His name's Wesley Chamantine.
Oh yes.
Right. Well, good old Leonard supposedly has paid $33,000 to this guy who is behind bars. And he supposedly has provided authorities with some maps where they might find what's indicated to be maybe 20 more bodies.
Oh, my.
Now,
you know, Leonard lights his cigars with that kind of money.
Right. Now, here's my question. This serial killer appears to be profiting from his crime. Now, the Los Angeles Times does point out that 18,000 of this money will go to probably pay restitution that he owes for something or other, but that still leaves 15,000. And understand, he's sitting on death row. Yeah, so I mean, yeah, it's not like he can go down to JCPenney's or Best Buy or anywhere like that.
Well, he may be out of cigarettes.
Right, but it does seem like, we have a killer, self-confessed killer, that is profiting from his crime. That doesn't sound right to me.
Well, he's going to spend it in the commissary.
Well, I don't know that that's the end of it, Simon, to the extent that their families and other people that probably have rights to some money. The only thing I'm going to say positive about this, because to me there's nothing really positive about this, is
Correct. Sometimes
the DA is willing to do this because he gets a lot of interest from families around him that would like to find lost loved ones who they believe might be victims of a particular serial killer, and they weigh very sharply the benefits to these families and whether or not to do this will in some manner help these families find some type of peace and closure. Now, while I don't support it, I obviously support anything that brings any family any kind of closure after a death of this nature. So that's the only caveat I have about this at all. Is
okay, and I am watching the clock here. TJ, a quick comment.
Yeah. I'm with the closure aspect of it all. Sometimes you have to weigh it, and you have to find the balance. I think the closure aspect of it is pretty darn compelling, pretty darn good. But always watch not necessarily what's the obvious, but what the other shoe might do.
Yeah.
Okay, folks, we're just about right out of time. I want to thank everyone.
Jan, any final parting thought?
Just that I hope that someday they'll come up with some answers to how to prevent anybody else from getting killed or another child being abused or anything. I just hope they can come up with some kind of answer.
TJ, it is always great to have you on the program, and I do hope you won't be a stranger. Any parting thoughts for us?
Let's find a little bit of peace and civility out there, folks. We're sorely lacking at it.
And where can people find you? You run, what, a three-hour daily show?
Well, that has changed. I'm now doing a four-hour morning radio program starting tomorrow morning, 5 a.m. to 9 a.m. locally in Des Moines on 98.3 Wow FM. And you can also listen live on the Internet if you so desire. And a lot of stuff to be discussed tomorrow, including the Grammys, Whitney Houston, and a whole lot of other things that are affecting our lives both locally and nationally.
So, TJ, will you start the show a little bit later so I can have some breakfast and get up and call you?
There's always that podcast that is so right there for everybody.
Come back, will you, TJ? And, Jan, don't be such a stranger. Our listeners love you.
They do love you, Jan.
Thank you for having me today. TJ, good hearing from you, too.
And Manny, it is always delightful to talk with you. You could provoke a fight with Indira Gandhi, I think.
Well, that's what I'm here for. I'm not in this show to be a peacemaker.
He's there to be a thought provoker.
By the way, TJ, this is because I had to talk to Cobra for 4 months, and look what it did to me.
Oh, yeah.
And
TJ, I was telling Manny earlier, I do believe that it was you that introduced me to Cobra.
It definitely was, because, we're out there stomping through the marshes and through the swamps and stuff like that out there in Florida, in Putnam County near Satsuma, and we wound up being on the same TV show together, and then it turns out that he discovered me undercover, and I said, my God, this guy's good. So we became friends after that, and still are to this day. He and I still have we have disagreements left and right, but I tell you what, it's always a good discussion. It's always rather animated.
Gotta love Cobra.
You gotta.
That's
he's
what
like your little
strange
brother, man. You gotta love him.
Yeah.
Yeah, TJ, that's what I call strange swamp fellows.
Well, they got real strange back in 2009 out there in February of that year, that's for sure.
Okay. So there you have it, Manny. The truth is out.
Good night, Gracie.
Good night, Gracie.
And this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a wonderful and safe week. And please join us again next Sunday. Who knows what we'll be talking about, but it's bound to be interesting.
It'll be compelling for sure.
Right. Till then, goodbye.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.